This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Dane Fitzgerald and Anatoly Karlin, and we're going to be discussing the long-term impacts of the pandemic. So that obviously includes all the civil unrest that has happened more recently. But to start things off, it's great having you guys on. Anatoly, you write for UNS, and Dane, if you want to give a brief introduction to yourself, and you two have actually met once.
Yeah, we met in 2015 at a Rachel Haywire-hosted event in San Francisco.
Like a warning, right? I think we discussed how the Crusades were a good thing and they did nothing wrong, right?
Yeah. In any case, I've been a writer for a while, living in the Bay Area. I haven't written too much recently, except for Twitter. I work full-time doing sort of content review stuff, which is sort of in the wheelhouse of a lot of controversial subjects as far as censorship, bias, and all that kind of stuff. But in any case, I've been living in the Bay Area for a long time, California resident, written stuff around different outlets, Splice Today, Rachel Haywire's Trigger Warning, the Jack Hunter publication Rare, some other things. American Spectator, yeah, that's one.
With the civil unrest, obviously the economic situation is a huge factor from the pandemic and the shutdowns. To start things off with, Anatoly, do you want to go back to your initial predictions on COVID-19? That article you wrote about Corona-chan cratering the world's economy, how accurate has your predictions, I think this was back in February, how accurate have they been so far?
Well, the precise title was, it was pretty hyperbolic. It seemed pretty hyperbolic when I wrote it, considering that even a month later, most Americans thought that it would kill no more than 10,000 people. But the title was Corona will kill millions and create the world economy. Pretty hyperbolic, but actually it seems to be coming pretty much literally true, because according to the official statistics, if you go to World Statistics or the Johns Hopkins University dashboard, there's been 400,000 deaths officially. Of course, we know from demographic analyses that so-called excess deaths, which is the amount of deaths we are having above baseline in countries which are competent enough to keep good records on this, they're about twice as much on average, 50% or twice as much as high as the official statistics on coronavirus. So really my guess is that actually a million have died, plus or minus a few 100,000 people. And as for the economy, I don't think that needs any particular explication. We seem to be having a pretty strong recovery right now, admittedly, but is it going to be a V-shaped recovery or a W-shaped recovery? That remains to be seen. We've had a huge injection of stimulus that's basically three times as much as in 2008. So we have this classic situation of unmovable object meeting an unstoppable force. So like these really, really huge collapse and huge stimulus. For now, the stimulus is winning, but will that remain the case indefinitely because coronavirus hasn't been contained? That's an open question.
Yeah, right now you're seeing Trump. I mean, obviously, Trump is from his perspective, he wants to be reelected, so he's going to say the economy is doing great. But even the kind of like mainstream center-left media has also been talking about the recovery. And yeah, you're right, there's been a modest recovery. But the question is how sustainable it is, because, coronavirus hasn't been contained. And I mean, right now it seems that the situation is being ignored, because conservatives have always had the kind of view, like the conservatives who view the concerns as a hoax. And then you have like the left has, they're not talking about it because of these massive rallies, which obviously are not social distancing. So
yeah, suddenly conservatives are very concerned about social distancing. Of course, you know, they mean it only to the extent that they're trying to point out hypocrisy, but it does put them at least superficially in sort of contradiction with themselves a few weeks ago, right? So, you know, they've both flipped positions implicitly.
Yeah, they have. Or some, I would say like the more intelligent conservatives have expressed concern, but there are some conservatives are just saying the fact that they're actually trying to say that it's vindicating their position, that is like, it's just the flu, bro. And I mean, that's obviously not the case.
It's only about six times worse than the flu, but yeah.
For sure. Well, you see all these like photos of these Vegas casinos reopening, and there's just these massive crowds inside the Las Vegas casinos. And I mean, a large number of people are not even wearing masks. And yeah, I mean, the whole kind of reopening. So, Anatoly, okay. What are the statistics on what have been the impacts on reopening? And you were telling me that you're pessimistic about the lockdown being reinforced.
I mean, obviously, I think it's going to be pretty hard to get people back in line. There's going to be a lot of sort of bottom-down social distancing that will continue. And incidentally, that is also another reason why I don't see the recovery being strong. I mean, China has gone up, and even though it's pretty much stamped out the coronavirus within its borders, the output still hasn't recovered to pre-coronavirus levels. And I mean, China was a very, very fast-growing economy. If it didn't happen there, I'm assuming it's certainly not going to be happening in the West either. Because I mean, are you going to be going to restaurants with the intensity that you would have been a year ago? Well, probably most people are not. I mean, even if younger people who don't really have much to risk from coronavirus will not pay much heed to it, more elderly people will, I assume. That's an important piece of context. And yes, it hasn't been contained. So as you know, they did lower it to around 0.9, 0.8 for a while. But those are not the kinds of figures that will suppress the coronavirus. To suppress it, you need to maintain those sorts of numbers for many months on end. So in Wuhan, the only country the only place in China which had an outbreak comparable to what we had in Italy or New York, London, and so on, they really clamped down really hard, and they brought R0 down to 0.3. And if you just do the mathematics, just a couple of months is sufficient to bring down the number of cases to zero or near zero with that kind
didn't
of
that,
the productive
didn't
number.
Didn't that include, just to interrupt real quick, didn't that include like certain measures that would probably be extremely unpalatable in the West, such as separating family members from each other and putting them in isolation? I guess there's, you know, the argument that people might float on in the U.S. or in Europe that, yes, they're getting the numbers down, but at too high a price. And,
well, yeah,
you know,
but
I have the American bias, and I'm kind of partial to that idea too, you know.
I mean, it's really, in my opinion, do you want like a couple of months of like totalitarianism in apostrophes, or a year or two of these grinding cyclical lockdowns in which you end up getting infected? I mean, I'd obviously opt for the former. Time limited, anyway.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. Just like a short term, but with Americans in general, they're just distrustful of any kind of a strong state power. But they're doing the places that have done that have it has paid off. I mean, New Zealand's another success story, but besides Asia, or a lot of Asian countries, I'm not sure if all Vietnam, I think Vietnam, yeah, Vietnam was a success story.
Yeah.
And just looking at different hotspots. So last time we talked, I think New York, the last time we talked, it was still New York was the main hotspot for the United States. And now it seems to be more, New York has recovered, but I'm not sure how long that will last, but it does seem the South, Southern states are emerging as greater hotspots. And then overseas, Brazil is emerging as the main hotspot globally, Latin America in general. Places like Italy have, they've recovered, and then Russia, last time we talked, Anatoly, you were saying that Russia has done a relatively well job, but it seems that Russia has spiked since the last time we talked.
Yeah, I mean, Russia obviously hasn't controlled. I mean, going back to your point about the importance of isolation, it seems that it's something that democratic and quasi-democratic countries in general have problems with. It seems that those really hard measures are only practicable in places like China, I suppose, or in countries, lots of East Asian countries controlled it, but they all contained the epidemic when it was still at a low level, when the traditional contact tracing methods could still be effective. I mean, obviously the efficacy plummets once you get into the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of infected, because it's not like you're going to be assigning so many people who are going to be attacking at that point.
So a place like England, right, it's apparently completely saturated in closed-circuit television. You know, in a place like that, and in Scandinavia as well, I think, is just generally more surveilled than the U.S., do you think the inability to do that has more to do with political will, or is it really a lack of technology, or some kind of combination of both?
Yeah, I mean, I think political will, obviously, and
doing more work.
Yeah, and some people are just. Obviously, if you've built out this infrastructure, then you might as well use it for something in the public good once in a while, instead of mocking people with having the most CCTV cameras per capita. But apparently that's not something the elites are very much interested in.
Or the whole tracking of people's phones. A lot of this the surveillance state is really disturbing. But I guess if it's inevitable, I'd agree that it might as well be used for something good in preventing the pandemic to spread. Looking at these protests, talking about whether there'll be a spike. So on one hand, it is outdoors, and the majority were wearing masks, like you do see widespread mask use. But then you also have to take into account like the sheer crowds of people like crammed into like one geographic area. So Anatoly, what impact do you think will the rallies have on the increase in the spread of the coronavirus?
Well, I think it's obvious that the conservatives will blame the protests and the libs will blame the reopenings. I mean, it's pretty much predetermined what people are going to be saying, I think.
I feel like progressive might see a conservative's, disdain for these protests that are happening right now and say, well, I'm going to raise you all of these images I'm seeing out of Las Vegas, you know, and other places that are not New York City or L.A. or San Francisco that are opening up. So, you know, it's just kind of this visual, you know, point and counterpoint thing we're moving into.
as for the reality, I've blogged about how it seems that indeed 95% of transmissions are indoors. I mean, I blogged about myself. But obviously the dynamics do change somewhat when you have crowds of such magnitude.
Do you think opening the beaches is a high risk?
I don't think that's high risk at all, or the parks. I mean, I'm not even sure, to be frank, that they should have been closed in the first place, because it's not like people gather in high concentrations there. And if you allow people to visit beaches, parks, and so on, one point I made early on is that we only have a limited amount of so-called quarantine capital, the amount of stress and psychological assault that people are willing to tolerate before they start folding and ignoring regulations. And so it's really a good idea to streamline your policies in such a way that you don't annoy people too much, so that they can, maintain the actually important rules for a longer period of time.
And with all this civil unrest, I know Peter Turchin is someone that you follow, and Vice had a report about his predictions, because I remember on the show we did about Andrew Yang, The War on Normal People by Yang, Peter Turchin, he has this theory of elite overproduction, and about a decade ago, he predicted like a major, either a collapse or massive civil unrest at Anatoly. Can you explain Turchin's key points why he predicted an event like this about a decade ago?
I mean, he identified cycles of rising and falling inequality, and as you say, elite overproduction. It's not something that just applies to Malthusian societies. Well, I mean, this time around, being in an industrial society, we won't have famines, but those social dynamics still remain in place. Once you have elite overproduction, I mean, one example of this is universities. Far too many people are getting degrees for the amount of high-paying jobs that would make use of their skill set. And I mean, let's be honest, I mean, the IQ is 100. Universities aren't going to, like, magically raise it by a standard deviation or whatever. In fact, they probably don't have much of an effect at all, to be frank. So you have these people with massively raised aspirations on account of them wasting 5 years of their life on a degree, and perhaps getting into tens of thousands of dollars of debt into it, who are frustrated in their ambitions. And I mean, what do you do? Well, you, for the radicals among them, you can join Antifa, you know, overthrow the system, make yourself the new elite. That would be one way out of it, I suppose.
Yeah, it seems like we're turning out more intellectuals, even if they're not, you know, top grade, but we're turning out something like an intellectual more and more often, even as the job market can't find a place for them. And I think you get, you know, especially in media, this is reflected. Eric Weinstein talked about this, how basically the collapse in traditional journalism is happening at a time when there are more would-be journalists than ever. And so you're getting a sort of gig work type journalism that's attracting people who are, you know, observant about what's happening in society. They're intellectuals, but they're not the top-tier intellectuals. Top-tier intellectuals are going into these more lucrative fields and leaving behind, you know, what was once a maybe 50 or 60K a year journalism job that's now been relegated to like 20K a year and, you know, only a few hours a week. They're leaving that kind of job for these new super abundant would-be intellectuals, right?
Yeah, and the thing is, if you're, like, for right-leaning people, you would obviously view these people as your adversary. But it is, I mean, this kind of applies to all angles. It is really problematic that we have so many people who are really intelligent, but they're also economically obsolete.
Right. So there's more time than ever to just consume all kind of, you know, social theory, to observe all kinds of things happening. On the one side, it's kind of academic, more theoretical. On the other side, it's like, you know, could be something as tawdry as muckraking journalism. You can bring all of that together to have some, you know, grand theory of the world that you just need to share with everyone, and you're being frustrated in the labor market at the same time. So,
I mean, with the events, like with the civil unrest, it does seem that the worst criminal behavior has been quelled. The more recent protests have been more peaceful. Or I should say in the United States, they've been more peaceful. It seems in Europe, things are different. But the implications will be longer lasting, like the political movements that come out of this. And I also predict, I actually predicted this anyways because of the economic, like if there is mass unemployment, we will definitely see like a rise in crime and more like isolated acts of looting.
So there's a couple of theories as they seem to be competing, right? So, you know, the claim is that we won't actually have a bunch of violence given mass unemployment, or even if it's short of violence, just a lot of, you know, destruction and social disharmony somehow, because everyone's going to be indoors playing video games, increasingly compelling, really good video games. But, you know, what we're seeing so far in the last few weeks makes me think that's not true. But of course, that can be broken down demographically, of course, you know, as to what type of person would opt to stay indoors and play video games versus be very, very frustrated and go out into meat space and, you know, vent their boredom somehow.
Yeah, like with the political implications, and it is spreading globally, and it shows like the impact of American cultural imperialism. So in Europe, there are damaging statues. The one in Bristol in the UK, they threw the statue of a slaveholder into the bay. In London, like vandalizing statues. I think we have a statue of Churchill and a statue of King Leopold in Belgium. So in Europe, it is explicitly like through a racial narrative. And then there are protests in Mexico, but I don't think it is. In Mexico, it seems to be more just against police brutality in general. In Brazil, there's anti-police protest. In South Africa, the Prime Minister, Ramaphosa, has been using it to stir up anti-white rhetoric. There's protest in Australia, so it is... Even protest, like a smaller-scale protest in Japan. So, yeah, it shows like the impact of American cultural imperialism to spread the kind of woke ideology.
Well, it's ironic that the kind of people concerned about cultural imperialism would be the first to deny that, right?
But, yeah, anyway. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was telling some people with the Russian Lives Matter and the way American SJWs getting extremely upset about that. Even though I'm dicing from Russia. But yeah, I mean, on that general point, I totally agree with you. It seems that the extent of these protests abroad, I mean, abroad, virtually all of these BLM protests outside America are just a kind of laughing, to be frank, or cargo culting the Americans. One thing I did notice, and one which I agree with you on, is that the extent of these protests in different countries seems to be very closely correlated to two factors, the amount of American influence there as proxied by pro-American geopolitical orientation and English language knowledge. So even if we look within Eastern Europe, the biggest BLM protests seem to have been in Poland, actually. There were much, much fewer of them in some place like Hungary. And the two guys who tried to protest in front of the American embassy in Moscow, they were arrested. That didn't go very far. It only exists on the internet amongst like some marginal SJWs, so far as Russia is concerned. A clear correlation on that.
Yeah, with this whole concept of the Great Awakening, it's been going on at least a decade, but does seem, or around a decade, it seems like the woke ideology is becoming more extreme. Like, they do have this religious, like, fervor, like, a lot of the footage are, like, these religious, like, ceremonies. So it will be interesting to see how that spreads. Like, will it lead to, like, more radical woke ideology among people getting into positions of power?
Yeah, it's interesting that people were predicting the final death of all of this woke stuff about 2 months ago. They're like, this time it's really going to be dead. I mean, this time it must be, because now we have a perfectly sort of utilitarian-oriented public health nightmare that will get people to finally just shut off all this culture war stuff and just. It seems like it came back stronger than ever.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, you have to be really careful about that, because. I first encountered these sort of woke SJW things in the early 2010s, but at first I thought it was just the internet, and it was only in my very last semester at Berkeley in which I encountered it in real life in the classroom. There was some girl in problem glasses who complained to the professor about, he showed some film about the Neanderthals in which some girl was carried off by a Neanderthal, and apparently it could upset people very much and trigger them if they have traumas and so on, and he had to apologize to her. So that was when I realized that the SJWs weren't just on the internet, on Tumblr, but had also, like, were also present in the universities. That was 2013. And then they sort of, you know, continued splitting and splitting like some kind of, you know, chaos infection on a in Warhammer 40K relentlessly. And now they just they seem to be everywhere in the U.S. They've graduated from the universities, and now they are marching through the institutions.
There's this assumption that wokeness is a kind of a product of like the decadence of prosperity, but I mean that's really hard to say because
cultural contradictions of capitalism.
Exactly. Seeing like if we go into a major economic decline, what impact will it have? The reaction of people who are economically devastated, whether they'll turn, whether they'll adopt an ideology or they'll turn to some kind of counter ideology that's opposed to that, because people do adopt radical ideologies in these times of hardship. And the other thing is, and there's the whole kind of a class angle, because like one theory that's been put out is that corporate elites are really pumping out a lot of the woke propaganda as a counterbalance to any kind of a class-based movement that would unite working class people along racial lines. So yeah, I mean, both Dane and Anatoly, like, what are your thoughts on the political trends over the next few years, depending on what happens, the outcomes, and what happens economically?
I have a question about the theory that the cultural contradiction of capitalism theory, if it's stating that, you know, prosperity creates this kind of radical fervor, culture war fervor, it looks like it's also the case that the opposite of that, you know, economic immiseration also creates that. So I don't know how that disrupts that thesis, you know, the original one. But I, as far as, you know, corporations, you know, virtue signaling or something, I think the virtue signaling, well, you were talking about how it's there's the idea that it's actually meant to distract from class conflict or class consciousness or any notion of inequality or something like that, and that they're doing this as kind of an easy cop-out. I don't know. I feel like that's sort of doing a, what is the term, typical mind fallacy or something? Where you're sort of attributing your own thought processes or inferring your own thought processes in others?
Objection.
You could even say like a conspiracy-minded person assumes that every decision has a kind of conspiratorial agenda behind it, which could be true in some cases, but it's maybe it's oversimplistic to always assume that.
So, but the corporate woke thing, the corporate culture warring thing seems to be pretty new, right? So why weren't corporations as interested in reducing class warfare in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s?
Well, the whole trend of woke capital, it really took off right after Occupy Wall Street. Some people were saying as a direct response against Occupy Wall Street.
No, I think,
I mean, to be honest, I mean, we have to. I think there's few people who would say that there's something organized and systematic behind it. I mean, firstly, all the SJWs, they've infiltrated the human resources departments because they're not that bright on average. So where else are they going to do? So the marketing departments and so on. So that's where they are. Going to be like doing their works. And secondly, if you look at that, many of them are actually pretty cynical. There was like a funny meme going around a few days ago in which Bethesda, the video games company, they changed their flags in Western Europe, their company headquarters flags, avatars on Twitter, to the rainbow flag, but they didn't change it in the Middle East or the industrial internet.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
It's pretty, so obviously it's pretty cynical, and I mean they're still no more interested in making money, but it's just driven by the underlying demographics, really. I think the sort of political demographics that we're seeing, these people have now graduated and they are now moving out into the workforce, they're becoming consumers.
The theory that, you know, once you left college, you'd be getting away from this woke stuff, and if you happen to believe in it personally, it would actually be a handicap in your search for a job. That turned out to be probably mostly incorrect. I say probably because I think if you're a high achiever, if you're like a star, you know, a potentially star employee, it might actually work for you to say a lot of this stuff. But if you're not such a star employee, I think it might be sort of a red flag that your head isn't really on the task at hand.
I do see a greater push for like a woke agenda in politics, like a greater push for more extreme woke agenda in education, academia. More like a push for more affirmative action.
Well, that those kind of institutions are already meant to sort of do something about that problem, you know, certain nonprofits and sectors of the state. But, you know, if you're making USB drives or something, I mean, what does that have to do with it? I think if you're a graduate of a top college, you can get away with saying certain woke stuff and they still think that you'll be a good hire. So it's a little bit misleading to say that, like, it's going to work for you to adopt all this stuff, just generally speaking. I think it only works if you're like, you know, a top graduate. I think that's more or less what the case is. For a lot of other people, it just looks like you won't be particularly good at your job because your heart's not really in it. I don't know.
And then there's this push to defund the police. I'm skeptical. There's a possibility that it could just be virtue signaling or a more sort of like partial defunding of the police and investing more in social programs. So I'm not sure if it's purely symbolic or how likely that will happen, but just going with the hypothetical scenario, it does happen. We'll definitely see, like, I mean, we're already seeing this. Like, I heard a report from on Twitter of this guy driving in Melrose in LA. I've seen more intensity of private security, and I think you will see like more of these nicer suburban communities around major cities in LA, the Bay Area, New York, Chicago. Like, they'll push to become like gated communities. So like a more, yeah, I mean, we could see that kind of trend. And regardless of the whole police issue, just because of if there's a crime wave, we could very well see that, likely see that trend.
Right. I mean, could there not be a bigger signal to people with means to, you know, scramble to provide their own security, their own little privatized solution, than talking about defunding the police, you know? I mean, it just seems like that would, like, spearhead a massive push toward even greater inequality, which is something that the left cares about. So more communitarian style conservatives as well.
Yeah, the whole thing, like, I think the past wave is where we saw this this white flight to the suburbs in response to the crime waves of the 70s. And I do predict that we will see like more urban decay in major cities like we saw in the 70s. And also, like, there's the whole issue of telecommunication, people leaving major cities, like, whether it will just be kind of, like, rinse and repeat, and we'll go back to that era, kind of where people move to the suburbs, but still hold on to more mainstream politics, or will it actually lead to more kind of a as you described, as, like, a communitarian conservative? Because the thing is that past era, there was stronger prosperity, and that allowed people to be hyper-atomized in, like, their suburban home. So yeah, it is possible that we could see a more communitarian conservatism.
I think we could get a repeat of that era, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, or late 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s. I think we could get that again, but with fewer homicides. We just don't have as many, able-bodied young men around to do that as we did then. So I think we'll get a lot of that malaise, but without some of the worst, most terrible aspects of it. Like,
and overall, it will really be bad for urbanism, and because the trends that we saw, like this push of people from the suburbs moving back to the city, gentrification, more urban like redevelopment, I think it will be bad for that. But we're already starting to see a major exodus out of cities because of the pandemic, economic issues, or remote work, and then crime would obviously an issue as well.
Yeah, a lot of what sent people here, I say here, like, I'm from Sacramento, I moved to the Bay Area, and a lot of people who would live in major cities, even if they weren't from somewhere in the middle of the country, they were in some, like, less exciting place within a, you know, two-hour radius or something. I think a lot of that is going to look less attractive. I think a lot of doing that is going to, you know, we're going to see less of it, because what's the point of moving here if you're, you can't go do anything, really? Because there's just too much, half the venues that you wanted to go to, and the gastro pubs and all that bullshit is just not around anymore. It makes it less exciting and attractive to move out of your parents' place if we're all online anyway. Right?
Another scenario is with the exodus out, like, we could see, like, all these, like, gentrifiers, like the hipsters who you see in places like Williamsburg and Brooklyn and the Mission District in San Francisco, if a lot of them move out to small town America, if anything, it could actually, you could see like more small towns that, because the thing is, they'll be isolated from a lot of the urban decay, but they might bring their values to small town America. So that's a scenario as well. And then telecommuting is that, I mean, that's a huge, huge trend, and it's already having an impact. Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing like real estate, like rent prices in the Silicon Valley are starting to significantly decline. And that's, I mean, that's part of the urban exodus. Dane, what have been your personal observations on whether there'll be a massive exodus from the Bay Area because of telecommuting?
I don't know. I think they're still going to prefer, when I say they, I mean, you know, companies, even if there is a generally telecommuting expectation, they are still going to want to have, I mean, that initial face-to-face interview. And then maybe sort of ad hoc face-to-face, or not interviews at that point, but meetings and whatnot. I saw a chart showing that a lot of the tech companies located in the Bay Area, the first people they laid off that were work from home, were located far away. So it still seems like it's better, all else being equal, to be nearby, even if you're working from home.
Do you see an exodus out of the Bay Area already?
Not really. I guess by that, it would just be sort of anecdotal, right? Like people on Facebook or something talking about it. And I haven't seen any of that yet. Still too soon.
I mean, it sort of makes sense, doesn't it? One of the benefits of the coronavirus epidemic is that there's going to be a lot of real life experiments on the practicalities of telecommuting and telework. My own job has been on that from March and probably will remain so for the foreseeable future. And also another thing is that the oil prices have collapsed, and so that obviously is something that militates for the suburbia. I mean, back a decade ago, or even 5 years ago, when some people still took peak oil seriously, there were discussions to the contrary that the end of cheap oil was going to lead to a remigration into the central cities. But it seems to be actually going the other way down. I mean, even when the sort of current epidemic passes, we'll by then be moving into the era when electronic vehicles start being produced in large enough numbers to actually have an effect on oil demand.
Well, in the past waves of like white flight to the suburbs, like people move to the suburbs to start a family. But the thing is, like, with this, like, next wave, like, that are mostly millennials, like, will they start families? Because, I mean, I know some people were joking about, like, a corona baby boom, but the trend overall has been, like, towards, like, rapidly declining birth rates.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect a baby boom. I mean, if you don't feel particularly good about the future, I mean, why the hell would you do that? But I guess there could be some accidental baby booms, but that's a very small portion of the population who aren't exactly very powerful, so.
I know, Anatoly, you posted that Twitter handle, that Twitter account that does cover, like, these different, like, fertility trends. Like, I mean, I'd say with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa, it does seem like, and there's maybe a few outliners, and I'm not sure if there's outliners in Europe or Asia, but it does seem overall, like, global trend has been for fertility decline.
Well, I mean, interestingly enough, the sort of huge, huge outlier amongst the first world countries is Israel, where the TFR is around 2.9 children per woman now. I mean, even the secular Jews in Israel have 1.8 or something like that, which is significantly higher than
the sort of equivalent. Doesn't that stem from Israel feeling like they're in sort of a baby arms race?
Probably a factor. I've actually recently come across a paper which found that women who were in some sort of military volunteer organization during the Second World War in Finland, they ended up having more babies than women who weren't. So it's like, you know, the sort of small brain is everybody needs to have equal rights to military service, then normal brain would be like, no, men are much stronger and better teamwork, only they should be conscripted. And then there's the galaxy brain, which says only the women should be conscripted to raise the birth rates.
Anatolia, how accurate is the whole theory of like the U-shaped trend in fertility?
Which U-shaped trend in fertility?
That rates are highest among the poor, but also the wealthiest and lowest in the middle class.
Oh, okay.
Obviously amongst the sort of very rich people, you do seem to have some pretty successful breeders, Elon Musk, who recently had his sixth, I think, right? Boris Johnson, Trump, obviously. Lots of these people. Amongst men, anyway. And it's well known that there's more amongst the low IQ as well. It seems it's lowest among the sort of normie 100 IQ university educated. That seems to be where.
I think it's not really a U-turn. I think I describe it as like the shape of a J.
Yeah, probably.
Letter
yeah.
J.
With immigration trends, that was a huge issue with Trump's election, and there's some disappointment with. But with the whole economic issue, do you see a massive decline in immigration waves over the next decade?
I mean, we don't really know what's going to be happening in sub-Saharan Africa because we had these sort of perturbations in the Middle East, which sent 2 to 3 million people from there to Europe, and the Middle East has. I believe something like 500 million people. Sub-Saharan Africa has well more than 1 billion by now, and it's going to increase to 4 billion by the end of the century on current UN projections. That's really going to all depend on what happens in sub-Saharan Africa and the porosity of Europe's borders.
Yeah, so that would impact Europe primarily, but looking at United States,
seems that Mexico has pretty much demographically died up already, and so the sort of last reservoir of surfeit manpower that you have is in the poorest Central American entities like Honduras, El Salvador, and so on. Obviously, you have much fewer people already than Mexico, even in absolute terms, and they're having a demographic transition as well. Unless the U.S. starts ferrying over Africans, I would indeed imagine that immigration to the U.S. will continue falling.
I think China actually surpassed Mexico as the top source of immigration to California, but at this point, I could actually see someone in China who is considering immigrating and then looking at all the chaos here and then maybe rethinking it.
Demand side issue with this as well. We talk about the population of sub-Saharan Africa and whatnot, but America's shining city on a hill type of image has been tarnished a great deal, and just we're sort of converging economically with a lot of other places, making us a lot less special in that way. So I mean how many people are really clamoring to get here? I mean, you've got, increasingly, you have to be in the worst of the worst places to be dreaming about the U.S.
Yeah.
And even then,
the U.S. upper middle class lives better than the European upper middle class, a lot better, actually. If you're talking about doctors and so on, lawyers, they just get twice as much money.
Yeah.
If you're talking about normies, the advantage isn't as big or doesn't exist at all. But I think another big factor is that for those same upper middle class people, China itself has become a lot more competitive. So if 15 years ago, the vast majority of Chinese students who moved to study in the U.S. stayed in the U.S., now the vast majority return to China, simply because if you go to Shanghai, it's very easy to get an American style salary in a financial or tech company in Shenzhen, and and the living costs are twice cheaper, so actually your money is even going to go further, and you're not going to be some sort of incel here either, because let's face it, the Chinese guys are not the most charismatic players around. So they have a problem with the girls in the U.S., but obviously not an issue in China itself.
You did see that trend with Taiwan and South Korea. They used to be major sources of immigration to the U.S., and they're not anymore because those... Yeah, I mean, South Korea is very successful. I mean, Hong Kong, I know Boris Johnson and then some American... Actually, Republicans have proposed giving refugee status to the Hong Kong Chinese.
Yeah, that's potentially 3 million people, and if, say, 1 million of them emigrates to Britain, that's basically probably the biggest Chinese minority by far in Europe. So that will be pretty interesting to see how it happens. I've speculated that this might turn Britain, which was formerly one of the most Sinophile countries in the Western sphere, into one of its Sinophobic, if those Hong Kong expats exert influence on British politics.
But if they're Hong Kong expats, isn't the idea that they would be more trustworthy somehow?
Well, in what sense? I mean, they'd be pissed off at China because they like the autonomy.
Well, I mean, both of you have lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. Have you noticed, divides? Like, one of the largest Chinese diasporas, is there a significant divide between people who support the mainland and between the more pro-Hong Kong or pro-Taiwan side? Like, what have been your observations?
My observation was that the more recent immigrants are pro-Chinese, whereas the older, more established immigrants are anti-Chinese. And I mean, that makes a lot of demographic sense because the early ones would have been the descendants of exiles or from Taiwan and so on, or just like the Republican exiles. And the later ones would just be students who probably don't even fit in that well as a general rule into American society and keep to themselves. And even become somewhat xenophobic because of their inability to navigate in U.S. society.
I would just add that Central Valley, California, seems to be home to more like Republican-leaning or conservative-leaning Chinese ethnicity. But I'm not so sure that's because of their views on China. It has more to do with something domestic, like the abolition of SAT tests and stuff. I don't know how different Bay Area Asians are politically, but I know it leans more toward Democrats or progressives.
Oh, yeah, I've noticed that, too. So, I briefly lived in Fresno, and there's both a Southeast Asian community and an Indian community. And in Fresno, they tend to be more conservative-leaning. That's obviously not the case in the Bay Area.
Yeah, when I grew up in Sacramento in the 80s, I had a friend named Qua. He was a Vietnamese dude, and... Yeah, that was when a lot of Southeast Asians and Chinese to some degree, we didn't hear about them immigrating as much then, but they were more conservative for geopolitical reasons, for, this kind of culture clash between communism and the West and all of that. And a lot of that has died down, tremendously.
Oh, yeah, the whole trend of there was a brief period in the 90s where Asians were becoming more conservative and... Now a lot of them they're more leaning more to the liberal side. Academia is a huge factor, and liberalism, wokeness is seen as like the ideology of the elite. We also on immigration with the whole H-1B visas. Do you think it's possible that we could see immigration with remote working immigration for H-1Bs being replaced with outright outsourcing?
Well, I mean, it hasn't happened so far, so I'm assuming that what can be outsourced has been outsourced, and I'm not sure that they'll figure out much more in the next 2 years, in particular.
Do you think that we could enter like a new Cold War of China, or a breakup of the Tri-America arrangement?
Oh, yeah, sure. I've been predicting that since 2018. I thought that it would actually be Trump's sort of biggest legacy. It seems to be one important thing I noticed is that it seems to have become genuinely bipartisan since 2019 at the latest. And ultimately, it boils down to the American deep state's realization that China isn't going to just be another Mexico, but 10 times bigger. It's going to be a peer superpower that has a realistic chance of overtaking U.S. hegemony, taking over the hegemonic mantle. And I mean, it's inevitable given the population's potential, similar human capital, but China has four times as many people. I mean, it's they were predicting that Japan would become the sort of giant to replace America in the 1980s, but that was never realistic because it had twice fewer people, but China is another beast. And so in this situation where the tension of a unipolar world, of like a globalized world, would inevitably lead to China coming to surpass, decidedly surpass the United States. So what do? You either try to contain China, which is really hard, obviously, or you try to fragment the world system. So if the world system is broken down into a bipolar system instead, then you get a sinosphere which China dominates, but the U.S. still gets to dominate its half of the globe because there's no European country which comes close to rivaling the U.S. On any parameter of power. And they don't aspire to, and even if they did, they wouldn't be able to do anything about it anyway. I mean, Germany, 80 million people, France, and Britain, 65 million people, America, 330 million people. I mean, it's just different scales.
So as far as Trump's reelection goes, all these different factors, the economy, the pandemic, and civil unrest, how do things look for Trump's reelection? And current polling between Trump and Biden, but that doesn't always prove the results. But what is your current election predictions?
I mean, I respect more than anybody the people who gamble, who have skin in the game, to borrow a Talibism. And the gamblers are currently putting 50% on Biden and 45% on Trump. I assume that's more than that's accurate.
Yeah, I think if all of this recent ruckus can be maintained somehow, I think Trump's out, because people sort of just watching from the sidelines are seeing that even if it seems to have taken 4 years, he's just an extremely polarizing figure. So they're going to be thinking that if he just gets out, all of this madness will end. And so that's sort of the lay perspective. But I mean, I haven't really looked at who is it? Nate Silver supposed to be some kind of expert?
Oh,
on this?
Yeah. There's Trump's handling, but do you think that some like moderate suburban swing voters will see Democrats as being too friendly to a lot of these like radical politics that have come out of the rallies?
No, I think they'll think that Biden is a good middle ground between a polarizing person like Trump, who encourages protesters, and then the protesters. I mean, his whole shtick is like a return to normalcy. He wants to go back to how things felt basically in 2012 or whatever. So, you know, I think they're just going to go with that. I got to jump off the phone.
Okay. Yeah, take care, Dane. It was great talking to you.
Yeah. Nice talking to you, Anatoly. Take care, Robert.
Yep. Bye. Mutually so. Bye, Dane. I agree with that analysis. The one thing I would say is that if Biden does win, he will probably be in a pretty weak position because the progressives barely like him any more than they do Trump. If you read a Reddit such as Chapel Tap House, then they pretty much hate him. They view him as a rapist. They know that he's less actually progressive than Hillary was in 2016. So they are going to be constantly sort of being a thorn in his shoe, pretty much. So that's going to generate some pretty interesting dynamics and will probably fuel the sort of instability that has really come to the fore this year.
Yeah, with his VP pick, do you see him choosing someone perceived as more moderate or going someone who's more favored by the woke crowd? I guess there seems to be like three groups within the Democratic coalition. The more establishment, the extreme woke angle, the sort of like rainbow coalition, and then the more kind of economic-minded people, those like three groups. So how significant is his VP choice?
I don't know. I mean, probably not too significant. I mean, according to the polls, one thing I tweeted recently is that there's a more than 50% chance that it's going to be a black woman former policeman. That's pretty funny, actually.
Or maybe, like, someone like Kamala Harris, she would actually alienate both the progressives and the moderates. But, like, mm-hmm. there's one example is, like, there's the mayor of Atlanta. She's a black woman, but she's also perceived as more moderate. So I think she might actually be... I could see him going with someone like her.
Mm-hmm.
And just with the, like, overall economic predictions, like, what do you see as, like, the economic predictions over the next year or so? Like, do you predict a depression? United States, different regions of the world, like, who has the strongest economy? Who's the most stable? Where will there most likely be an economic collapse? And then there's also the issue of, like, a debt crisis will be an issue, too.
Mm-hmm.
Both businesses going bankrupt, governments, larger governments and local governments, state governments and local governments and national going
well, yeah, sure,
as well.
Sure. I think the most dynamic countries would obviously be those that aren't going to be hampered by this epidemic yo-yo, as one person on Tyler Cowen's blog called it, or cyclical lockdowns, which are going to be like happening in the US and in Europe, even if not officially enforced, but people are still going to be having these periodic panics whenever coronavirus spikes. I mean, that's my assumption. I assume that we bottomed around March, but I don't think that it's going to be a sharp V-shaped recovery so long as the coronavirus crisis is still in the background. That's the first point. The second point is that which are going to be the best countries? Well, I mean, probably East Asia, the East Asia region in general, for those same reasons. Although one problem they do have is export dependency of manufactured goods, and there's not many buyers. So, I mean, it depends on the extent to which domestic consumers there will compensate. Yes, the debt crisis, PIGS debt crisis, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, they weren't permanently solved in the early 2010s. They were just kicked down the road. So what's going to be happening there? Who the hell knows? I mean, everybody's going deep into the red right now. And the tourism sector is going to collapse this year. And tourism makes up 10% of Greece's and Portugal's GDP, and about 7% in Spain and Italy. So, I mean, that's going to be a pretty damaging blow to already pretty stressed economies. The Germans are no more enthusiastic about issuing European-wide bonds than they ever were, so far as I know. That's a potential crisis to watch out for, perhaps not this year, but I assume in 2021.
Yeah, as far as the pandemic goes, in the poor nations of the Southern Hemisphere, do you see the pandemic getting a lot worse? Obviously, it's bad in Brazil now. I'm not sure about, I'm not really sure about Sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia. I mean, Modi in India has done fairly well, but it still could grow there as
yeah.
well.
I mean, yeah, it's going there. I mean, they locked down pretty hard. And to be honest, I was skeptical about the sort of cost benefits of locking down for third world countries. I mean, I think the calculus favored it in the first world, but was it worth it in the third world where you have young populations and much, much lower safety margins in terms of economic survival? Well, I'm not sure that it was a good idea. I'm glad that I wasn't the one making those decisions at any date. But yeah, I mean, Modi's problem is that the epidemic in India doesn't even appear to have been flattened. And you can't really lock down for a long period of time in a country such as India for obvious reasons. So that's going I assume that there's going to be a lot of chaos now in the third world. The one bright spot that they do have is that populations are obviously a lot younger than in the first world. So the average, the median age in Africa is around 20 years. In India, it's around 30 years, if I recall correctly. Versus 45 years in Japan and Germany, around 40 years in the US. So all else equal, you'll have many more people in the first world dying. Although one sort of counterpoint is that people in the most sort of squalid and in the developed countries, third world countries, they're also more fragile because they've had more like endemic diseases and more malnutrition and so on. So they might be potentially more vulnerable to COVID-19. But whether that's a sure fact, well, I don't think anybody knows yet.
I know in South Africa, the number of fatalities from the coronavirus it's relatively low, but they do have one of the most draconian lockdowns, and they're definitely at major risk for economic collapse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we'll see over the coming months. I mean, but it does seem to be like a pretty common outlook that the sort of East Asia would be the least affected, and the Western countries would be moderately affected, and the real chaos is just about to begin now that it's reaching the critical expansion phase in the third world.
Yeah, at this point, Brazil is probably in the worst case, both with the pandemic and with the economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Bolsonaro is an idiot, actually, because I mean, like, even if you strongly believe that it's just the flu, bro, and well, whatever, but I mean, normal people don't believe that, and the governors have simply, from what I've been reading, have simply been defying Bolsonaro. So he has lost significant control of the political apparatus, and his approval ratings have plummeted relative to what they were at the beginning of the year. So, like even if you do think that it's this overblown thing, it's obviously wasn't a good idea from just a practical political perspective to signal against it.
Anatoly Karlin, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on, and check out his articles on UNS.
All right, thank you. It's always good to be on your podcast.